Well, my topic flows right on from Jane's. I'm going to talk about the sustainability movement, but I'm going to work my way into it a little bit indirectly. Assaults on the truth are not always what they seem. Sometimes they are very direct, and other times they are quite circuitous. On the National Association of Scholars website, we, like Jane and the Pope Center, are following a lot of different threads. In preparing for this, one that occurred to me was an article in the Teacher College Record, a journal that bills itself as the voice of scholarship in education, came out earlier this year. And in the Teacher College Record, there is a professor of education named Barbara Applebaum, who held forth on why social justice education should be part of all American education. Now, the oddity that struck me here was that, this is quoting Barbara Applebaum, teaching for social justice is indeed an exercise in ideology, but under conditions of systemic injustice, promoting, now I'll use my own words here, promoting leftist dogma in the curriculum is only fair. Why? And back to her words, it's because leftist dogma promotes rather than arrests criticality. Okay. So we're talking about an assault on the truth here, I think we would all agree, but it's one that sort of is proud of itself. Truth, get out of the way. Social justice is more important. Now, the other assault on truth that I wanted to start with, you may recognize John Keats's famous Ode on a Grecian Urn ends with the following lines: "When old age shall this generation waste? Thou," he's addressing the urn, "shall remain in midst of other woe than ours, a friend of men, to whom thou sayest, beauty is truth, truth beauty. That is all ye know on earth and all ye need to know." Well, that's obviously a lie. Truth and beauty are not the same thing, but it's a sweet, seductive lie. And many of the assaults on truth aren't really assaults. I see that we framed this in a sort of military metaphor that truth is out there being battered down by the likes of Barbara Applebaum, but that's not always the case. Some of our assaults on truth are much more in the form of sweet seductions, of appeals to things that sound good and right to at least many of us, and yet turn out in practice to involve something quite different. And I think that's where I would put the sustainability movement. It has its thuggish side, which Jane has been describing, but not all of it is like that. Now, sustainability. I'm going to suspect that even in this audience, that word probably has mainly positive connotations. It sounds like something nice. Sustaining is a whole lot better than the wastability movement or something like that. So shouldn't we be in favor of it? Well, just what is it? The sustainability term has truly hundreds of definitions. We have an issue of academic questions coming out in a few months, and one piece of it is we've asked a philosopher to pore over some of those definitions and see what kind of coherence he could find in them. But perhaps the definition of sustainability that is most widely used, I'm scrambling around among papers here, comes from a 1987 UN report called the Bundtland Commission report, and in it we learn that this is sustainable development is development that meets the needs of the present without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their needs. Now again, that sounds kind of sweet. We don't really want to rob our children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren of the possibility of thriving on this planet. And surely we should be so mindful of how we use the things that we use, fuel, resources of all sorts, in a manner that we leave some kind of positive legacy to future generations. That's the appeal that's being made here. You know, if you're a cold-hearted philosopher, you look at this, that language of compromise the ability of future generations. Well, any time you use any resource, you're taking something away from the future. You're also making the assumption that the future is going to be dependent on using the same kinds of resources in the same kinds of ways that we do. All that's highly questionable, and the sustainability doctrine frequently founders on this point, that sustainability as an idea sounds a lot more positive than sustainability in practice. Well, how does this come into a discussion of higher education? Well, I'll get to that, but let me try one more way of framing this thing. Assaults on the truth are common in our society and in any society. I think it would require something like a modern-day Audubon cataloging the birds of America to try to get all the different forms of mendacity that are around us cataloged and displayed in some useful way. Surely the forms of lying that compromise our search for the truth, our truth-seeking in general, are as varied as the flamboyant flamingos of our politicians that ostentatiously lie to us, the clouds of starlings that make up the mass media that manage to block out the light of truth wherever it dares to show itself. One could continue the metaphor, but the point here is that sustainability comes in to this discussion not as one of those excrescences of the university itself. Now, Steve mentioned in his introduction, I wrote a book about diversity. Diversity is a creature of the university. It lands on the scene in Justice Powell's decision in 1978 in Bakke versus the Regents of the University of California as a justification for racial preferences in college admissions. And after that, it's college officials, mainly faculty members, sometimes administrators, who take this idea and elaborate it into a giant ideology for dividing Americans into identity groups and distributing social goods by means of an ideology of oppression that has visited these social groups in the past. Sustainability has a completely different origin and history, and it's only lately found its way into the university. I'll grant Jane's exception that the global warming theory part of it came out of the university, but there's a lot more to sustainability than that. Now, this is a long story, and I don't have time to tell it, but let me put in a few benchmarks for you. The American love of environment, of nature, as I think we used to say, goes a long way back, and it's not an unmixed thing. Our ancestors sometimes viewed nature as horrid and a howling wilderness to be conquered, but we also had Hudson River School painters and Thoreau and others who looked upon nature as something more benign and something to be learned from. That strain in American character that looks to nature as having a salvational component to it never goes away. It has periods of popularity and less popularity. By the early 20th century, it had emerged into a conservation movement. We had Teddy Roosevelt establishing our first national parks. The current sustainability movement lays claim to that history and promotes itself as its rightful heir. But it's not really where the sustainability movement came from. For that, we have to turn to something relatively more recent. Probably the benchmark book of the sustainability movement was the 1962 book by the marine biologist Rachel Carlson, Silent Spring. The metaphor of the title is that she looks out her backyard window and there are no more robins and spring birds greeting her with their songs. What's gone wrong? Well, we've poisoned our environment. And Carlson becomes, although she doesn't live much past the initial popularity of that book, she gets the idea across very effectively to middle-class Americans that the way in which American industry is polluting the environment has robbed us of a legacy, and something drastic needs to be done. Carlson is quickly followed by another popular figure of the 1960s, Barry Commoner, who lays claim to some scientific credentials behind this. From Carlson and Commoner come a pretty respectable middle-class movement that says we need to get really serious about air pollution and water pollution. And that culminates in Earth Day, 1970. April 22nd, 1970 is the first Earth Day. Approximately 20 million Americans turned out to celebrate that event. That put that movement on the map. Now, parallel to Carlson and Commoner, but much less visible to most Americans, was what was going on the American left during this period. Khrushchev had come in the 1950s and repudiated the Stalinist legacy. The American Communist Party, American socialists in general, began to despair that their long-term hope, nurtured over many decades, had come a cropper, that the American proletariat, American labor, just wasn't responding to the need to bring to power an approach founded on workers' rights. And theorists of the movement began to cast around for something else. Perhaps most noticeably, we had the emergence of the New Left in 1962 with Hayden's Port Huron statement. But also in 1962, there was a more obscure figure named Murray Bookchin. Bookchin was an old-time Stalinist who broke with the party in the late 1930s because he couldn't stand its discipline and became an anarchist. But he also found that the anarchists were too organized for him. So by the late 1950s, Bookchin broke apart and became a party of one, still much interested in radicalizing America, but having completely given up on the idea that the proletariat was the avenue for doing that. So he created a new approach, first enunciated in a 1962 book, that seems to be the year in which things get moving here, titled Our Synthetic Environment. The argument of this book is that the left can come to power in America by tapping into Americans' love of nature. And once it's realized that the rape of nature is no different from the exploitation of humanity, we can bring all Americans together on the theme of redeeming nature. Bookchin's book, as far as I can tell, was widely ignored, but it came out 6 months before Silent Spring, and Bookchin was buoyed by the success of Carlson's book and more or less turned the next 40 years of his life into being a champion of the synthesis of left-wing reconstruction with radical environmentalism. He wasn't very good at working with other people, but he was very good at getting his ideas into circulation on the leftist fringe. So, for example, the group Earth First, which you may have heard of, that's Earth First with an exclamation point as part of the name of it, were essentially a reactionary group to Bookchin. They thought Bookchin has the right idea, but he hasn't gone far enough. We're going to take it still further. All right, that's another strand of this. So we have the Carlson-Commoner side leading to Earth Day. We have Bookchin and Earth First taking a more leftist synthesis of this. And in 1971, we had the first UN Convention on Wetlands of International Importance, especially as waterfowl habitat. Not one of the great moments in the history of the UN, but the first of now some 30 treaties and international agreements that have brought the United Nations and UNESCO into the picture as the leading international bodies that have focused on sustainability. I mentioned the Brundtland Commission report of 1987, that's technically titled the World Commission on Environment and Development. It led directly to the Rio Summit in 1992 with its UN Earth Summit the same year. There have been, as I said, so many of these that I would just take up my time listing all of them, but you've heard of the Kyoto Protocol of 1997, the Earth Charter of 2000. In 2005, we began the decade, we're now halfway through it, the UN Decade on Sustainable Development. Okay, what does all this have to do with higher education? One connection is that two of the participants in that 1992 Rio Summit were Senator Kerry of Massachusetts and the widow of Senator Hines, Teresa Hines, not yet married. They had known each other a little bit, but they really got to know each other at Rio. When they came back, they co-founded an organization in Massachusetts called Second Nature. Second Nature had a third partner to it, a dean of environment at Tufts University, and it set out as its program a very narrow and specific idea. It wanted to bring the sustainability movement out of international organizations to the American college campus. Its objective was also a little bit odd in another respect, is they had no intention of trying to sell sustainability to students or to faculty. There was no sort of organ of promoting this idea. Instead, they had a very precise avenue of influence. They were going to recruit American college presidents to adopt this thing as central to their campuses. And to that end, they created the American and College University President Climate Commitment. It's taken them quite a while, but that commitment has now been signed by 858, I checked the figure 2 days ago, American and College University Presidents. Now the title sounds Climate Commitment like it's in Jane's territory, and partly it is. It's partly about the climate, but what's happened with sustainability, and here's the rub of all this, is that the climate part of it is simply on the surface. They are concerned about, they say, climate change, although this document's old enough to still use the words of global warming. But it's also concerned that you can't have sustainability, a sustainable society, without taking some other steps. You have to dismantle capitalism, for example, because capitalism is based on exploitation of resources, and in their notional view, we're doing away with exploitation, period, and exploitation of resources and exploitation of people is basically the same thing. The sustainability movement views the reconstruction of human social relations as critical to this enterprise as well. So we have to do away with sexism, racism. We have to do away, in the more extreme versions of this, with private property. Sustainability turns out to be a kind of soft way into a really radical utopian movement. I've adopted the word sustainatopians to capture this. These college and university presidents who are signing on now represent over a third of the students in America, the college students in America. So this has got breadth, if not depth. I'm winding up my clock here. This movement is a soft form of totalitarianism. It has within its agenda the desire to get into the heads of college students. It uses both large and small arguments to do that. It, for example, now is promoting the banning of cafeteria trays in universities, so students have to juggle a bunch of dishes and be mindful that they're saving energy while they do this. Of course, the thrust of Second Nature, the organization that promotes this entire thing, is that sustainability is, I'll use their own words here, a commitment for the leaders of higher education to make healthy, just, and sustainable living the foundation of all learning and practice in higher education. To unpack that would take time I don't have. Let's see if I can just draw yet another avian metaphor into this as a way of pulling this together. Sustainability has an apocalyptic vision driving it. Jane refers to this notion that the world is going to collapse if we don't give up our rational, scientific, industrial civilization on the way there. It views the future as very bleak, but it offers a salvational moment in its secular vein to students who agree to make themselves part of this great effort. That, to me, brings to mind those final words from our modern pagan poet, Wallace Stevens, who conjures up at the end of his great poem, Sunday Morning, in the evening, casual flocks of pigeons make ambiguous undulations as they sink downward to darkness on extended wings. Thank you.